Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced at 94.9 CHRW in London, Ontario, on the traditional territory of the Attawandaron, Anishinaabe, and Haudenosaunee people. We are your hosts, Sarah Mae Chitty
and Isiana Bastari, in this episode.
Well, hi there. My name is Dana. I play in several bands in London town. The show I play tonight is with
and
Twin
I think Finn. That having that male presence lifted from the SPHR side also emboldened more to come. And I'd say that it got up to about 17 men that were surrounding Rhonda in the atrium.
And we work specifically on cognition, so on learning, memory, attention, and phenomena like that.
But first, here are your headlines. The Black Lives Matter Toronto Coalition has set up a tent city outside the Toronto City Police headquarters. They have been camping out in resistance since Sunday, when the police announced last Friday that they would not be pressing charges against the police officer who shot and killed unarmed Andrew Loku last summer. Black Lives Matter organized a rally at Nathan Phillips Square on Sunday, culminating in the tent city. The tent city is now running into the end of its first week with no intention of letting up until demands are met. Yusra is a leading organizer with Black Lives Matter.
Okay, so we came together on Sunday evening because we received so many negative news coming to the Black community in the past week. We found out that the killer of Andrew Loku was not charged, and this was an injustice because they released this announcement on Friday evening because they thought that no one was going to care and it was going to flood into the weekend and nobody was going to pay attention. But we have been devastated. We also heard within that week that Afrofest, which is a massive festival that Black Torontonians come into a space to be able to heal and share our culture, our music is being cut from a two-day festival to a one-day festival. We think that this is an absolute injustice because it's a violation of our community. There is no consultation to us as a community about any part of this decision-making, and this is a problem. So we decided to come together on Sunday evening at Nathan Phillips Square to host a mini Afrofest. We had artists in the space, music in the space, children and elders. We decided to hold the space also to honor Andrew Loku's death, but also to fight against police brutality and how many Black people have died at the hands of police.
Black Lives Matter protesters have been receiving lots of support from people around the city and solidarity from Indigenous land defenders.
We've been having absolutely like tremendous, unwavering support from the Indigenous community. They've been riding with us from the jump. So we've been here for like 3 days since the beginning. They've been trying to help us heal. They've been protecting us. They've been blessing the land and supporting us through all the violence that we experienced.
According to the Black Lives Matter Facebook group, Toronto police shut off the power outside their headquarters on Thursday morning, leaving protesters in the dark, just as the city was feeling the effects of a late March ice and snowstorm.
Some of our demands that we're putting forward is for the name of the police officer who killed Andrew Loku to be released and made public, for the footage in which Andrew Loku was killed in his apartment complex to be made public information. In the United States, people have access to these modes of accountability. Here in Canada, we don't have access to this mode of accountability. So we're fighting for that. We're fighting for an overhaul in the SIQ. We're fighting for accountability for Andrew Loku's death. And we're fighting for us to be able to exist without being attacked and to be able to be free.
Organizers are calling for an all-out day of action at police headquarters for Saturday. Groundwire will keep you posted.
It's been almost a month since the president of Western University's Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights student organization was surrounded by 15 to 20 men and verbally attacked on campus, and the silence surrounding the attack is getting uncomfortable for some students. SPHR President Rhonda Albayumi and fellow member Marie Rue were participating in the club's annual Israeli Apartheid Week in the university's community center on February 29th.
All of the clubs have their atrium day, and it was SPHR's atrium day. The focus of the event was about the West Bank and the separation and lack of freedom of movement that exists for Palestinians in the West Bank.
During this event, the women were approached by supporters of Israeli protesting their presence in the atrium. According to Marie, discussion began between members of SPHR and their protesters, and the protesters started to get heated. Approximately 12 protesters surrounding the SPHR president and another executive continued to argue with them about the event.
They were surrounded at this point. The other executive was a man, and he had distanced himself too. And I think that having that male presence lifted from the SPHR side also emboldened more to come. And I'd say that it got up to about 17 men that were surrounding Rhonda in the atrium, like shouting from all sides. Some of them called her a terrorist and things like this. At that point, we contacted the USC and decided that campus police should be called in to break down.
A USC administrator tried to break up the group, but was challenged by the protesters that she was stifling her free speech. It was not until campus police arrived that the situation was diffused.
I think it's also important to notice that this is not something that has come out of nowhere. SPHR executives, primarily women and primarily visible Muslims, have faced abuse on campus for years now. I know I've personally, in my time organizing, been both spit on and stalked, and I'm the white girl in the club. The other girls have faced issues where people go to their professors and try to turn them against them. They've faced physical intimidation. They've faced straight-out racism and blatant racism on the campus. And none of those have really been fundamentally addressed by the university. Sometimes it's sort of a reactionary response to something in particular that happens, but there's been very little institutional shift in the way that we look at things.
In the days following the incident, no formal communication between the University Student Council and SPHR evolved. Marie says the silence is unwarranted when the safety of a student was threatened while engaging other students in political discussion. She then wrote USC President Sophie Helpert a letter asking her to acknowledge what happened and clarify this kind of behavior is not tolerated. It was not until the letter went viral and was published in the Western Gazette that Sophie reached out to SPHR to set up an appointment for the next week.
We're sort of at this point establishing what we feel would be an appropriate response, which at this point we're feeling would be official formal condemnation from the USC, a minor apology maybe from Israel on campus, and we feel that there should be sensitivity training, particularly to how you shape your message on campus for executives in the following years.
It is not known whether the aggressors were part of another club, Israeli on campus, and Marie says SPHR is not holding them accountable for the particular incident. A police investigation was launched but quickly closed because campus police were unable to identify Rhonda's harassers. Despite the best efforts, Marie says this violence has not dampened the group's passion and they will continue to be active on campus.
You just heard Genocide by Whoopso. They just released that track on Pentagon Black's paper compilation of Canadian DIY bands. Now it's time for our feature stories.
Western University cognitive behavioral neuroscience researchers are breaking grounds in finding more about Alzheimer's disease. Jocelyn Wong investigates the new discoveries and research methods Western neuroscientists are using to learn more about cognitive diseases. Take a look.
What actually happens to the brain of patients with neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's? Lisa Saxida and Tim Bussey from Western Research Chair in Cognitive Neuroscience tell us more about mice, milkshakes, and touchscreen tablets. So what brought you to London all the way from the UK?
Well, you know, it's funny. We weren't thinking about moving. So we were based in Cambridge, which is a wonderful place to be. It's a wonderful place to work and live in. But we came to visit Western last year, and we're just completely blown away by the attitude here. So everyone that we met was just really interested in science and fantastic and wanted to set up collaborations and the resources and community, the neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience community here at Western is just really very exciting. I guess what Western has done over the last few years as put a massive investment into cognitive neuroscience as a particular area of focus for the university.
I heard a part of the reason was also because the Robarts Research Institute. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, that's one of the things that Western is really known for, is the imaging facilities and the imaging experts that they have here. We're also in the Brain and Mind Institute, and so there are a lot of people doing imaging there that we're looking forward to collaborating with.
You two are involved in a research in London right now, are you?
And we work specifically on cognition, so on learning, memory, attention, and phenomena like that, and how those processes are based in the brain, and how they work in the healthy brain, and also how they work in brains that are damaged by disease or injury. And one of the things that we're interested in doing with our research is improving translation from basic science into the clinic. So one of the things that we've developed is a method for testing models of Alzheimer's disease and other diseases, mouse models in particular, on the same types of cognitive tests that you would test a human patient on. One of our tasks is a task where you have to remember an object in a particular location. Correct. So our mice interact with a touchscreen type system, which is like an iPad, and they're rewarded with strawberry milkshake when they get answers correct. And this is very similar to the way that you would test a human, as opposed to putting them in a maze or something like that. And so it's actually quite difficult to do because you have to map multiple objects onto multiple different locations. And it turns out that mice are pretty good at doing this task. And this task is really interesting because it's a task that seems to be very sensitive to picking up on Alzheimer's disease very early on, before people are showing any of the more significant memory impairments that would take them to the clinic. But we are also building collaborations with people here in London at the moment. So Marco and Vania Prado, for example, we're working with them, and we may actually start some behavioral experiments using their lab space in the near future.
How are the mice similar to humans in the way they think, I guess, is my next question.
It's a good question. Do you want to?
Well, it is important that these models have what we call neurocognitive validity, meaning exactly what you're saying, so that when a mouse solves a particular test in the laboratory, that they're solving that test in the same way that the human solves the test, meaning the same brain circuits, or the same psychological processes.
What advantages does working at Western give you in your research?
We need people working at the molecular level, at the circuit level. I think mouse models are part of that, an important part of it. Again, imaging is incredibly useful for understanding Alzheimer's disease. So as with anything in cognitive and behavioral neuroscience, it's really a converging approaches. All of these different methods, different species and different levels of analysis have to come together to solve a problem as difficult as something like Alzheimer's disease. A lot of that is now involving some very modern and exciting methods that we can use to probe the brain. Some of those methods, you may have heard these, that you can drive neurons with light or put designer receptors into into the brain, you know, and then these are things that we haven't done that much of in Cambridge. And it's those kinds of new and exciting methods that we're really looking forward to taking forward here. We think it's going to take our research to the next level, really. A part of the reason that we think we can do that probably better here is because of the resources and because of the collaborators that we're that we've encountered here, people who have expertise in these areas, so we can kind of marry our behavior with their molecular and circuit level approaches to do those kinds of experiments.
That's right, because each of these different techniques and each of these different levels of analysis allow us to ask slightly different questions. Mm-hmm. And it's bringing all of those different, the answers to all of these different sort of smaller questions together that's going to help us really develop an understanding of these diseases.
What are generally the biggest differences or similarities that you found in your research lab or peers as compared to your colleagues at Cambridge?
One thing about Western that's quite different from Cambridge is this level of institutional support for mm-hmm. cognitive neuroscience. So I think that is actually really unique to see a university put so much kind of, emphasis on a particular area to really facilitate the work that the scientists want to do. And that's a really nice thing about being at Western.
Yeah, I think so. And I think when I was mentioning resources, I think of a lot of the resources that we're hoping to use, imaging, microscopy, and so forth. Here, they're very easily accessible, and the whole thing is, we think, very well organized, and it just makes it easy to integrate all those different approaches. I think they'll make a difference here, simply because of the type of work we want to do, which is so integrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
For several months, the federal government and much of the country has been gripped by the plight of Syrians escaping desperate circumstances. With the crisis dominating international headlines, the Liberal Party had made a firm commitment to introduce to Canada 25,000 refugees from Syria. However, many observers argue that the situation for refugees in African countries face similarly daunting circumstances and should be extended the same benefits as the Syrians. The following report, put together by CKUW contributor and news director Michael Welch, highlights some of these arguments and the individuals making them.
On Thursday, March 17th, dignitaries, refugees, and community members alike gathered at the Manitoba Interfaith Immigration Council, otherwise known as Welcome Place, to greet an announcement of $500,000 in funding from the federal government's Welcome Fund for Syrian Refugees. These funds are intended to assist the settlement of refugee families in the city of Winnipeg. Advocates for non-Syrian refugees, however, see a serious deficit in the government's approach. Ali Said is a former political prisoner from Ethiopia. He's a longtime refugee advocate and award-winning human rights activist. Said tried to approach John McCallum, the Minister of Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship, who had been on hand for the announcement to air his concerns.
My fear is, I think the African refugees being forgotten.
Okay, I know.
To me, this is what I want to do.
Okay.
Outside?
Thank you. Okay. I understand.
Hello. That's not a good answer.
I feel the African refugees are being neglected. The refugees who are suffering in Libya, over 500 refugees are in prison in Libya. If you remember, last year, 30 Ethiopian Christians were slaughtered by ISIS. So the ISIS is abusing and killing and torturing refugees in Libya, but the refugees, especially in Libya, Eritreans, Ethiopians, Sudanese, are not considered as a refugee or what? They have to increase the number of the refugees to come to Canada, especially the African refugees who are suffering a lot in those places.
Gazai Hagos is a refugee from Eritrea and a former journalist. He spoke about the cap that was placed on Canadian visa offices abroad, which limited the number who could come to Canada.
So we have been calling the Canadian government to acknowledge this and give us, you know, at least some sort of resettlement options for at least immediate family members. We understand that you cannot bring everyone, but at least if they can allow us to bring our immediate family members, brothers and sisters or cousins or those who are really in desperate need, and at least allow us lifting part of the caps or sub-caps they put in this very important visa process that are the Nairobi visa post and the Cairo visa post. The UN Human Rights Commission has acknowledged and assigned a special rapporteur to investigate the human rights situation in Eritrea, and after credible reports of that special reporter and other sources, they also put up a commission of inquiry to investigate on Eritrea and human rights situation. And the commission of inquiry has, after seven months of investigations, where it has heard firsthand from victims of human rights situation in Eritrea, and in June 2015, it produced a report, 484 pages report, that said, yes, there is a widespread and systemic human rights violations in Eritrea, and that may constitute crimes against humanity. There are very few governments that has been subjected to that.
Hasim Ismail is himself a Malaysian seeking refugee status. He is chair of the student refugee program on campus and a member of the No One Is Illegal Winnipeg chapter group. Ismail recognizes the preferential treatment being given to Syrian refugees.
Syrian refugees, the ones that arrived after the Liberals came into power, have their travel loans waived. And the current refugees and the ones that are coming in that are not from Syria will still arrive in Canada with debt or of around $3,000-ish. If it was you and you're struggling to like pay the rent, and then somebody new arrives and gets a rent paid for because the media is just buzzing about it, and you start thinking, wow, I wish I had media attention. I talked to several Rohingya refugees, and that's the most persecuted group in the world. It's really sad how people have just basically not jumped to help them.
None of the participants in this report begrudge the Liberal government for their generosity towards Syrian refugees. They would simply like to see some acknowledgement from high officials, the media, and society at large of the legitimacy of the appeal for support for refugees of all backgrounds. From Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the heartland of the Métis Nation, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
In that report, you heard from refugee advocate Ali Saeed, Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Minister John McCallum, Eritrean refugee Gozai Hagose, and Malaysian-born chair of the Student Refugee Program on the University of Winnipeg campus and a member of No One Is Illegal in Winnipeg Treaty 1 territory.
Our next feature is an exploration of the impact of venues on London, Ontario's music scene. Sylvia Pozek has the story.
It's springtime, and just over a year ago, I was celebrating my birthday with friends and family and a stellar band at the Blackshire Pub. And today, not a trace of the building is left. The APK has closed, but the Vic Tavern is back. I recently spoke with a few members of London's music community about their experiences and thoughts on the music scene and venues in our city. You'll also hear from Londoners who love live music.
London is so full of creativity, and I like to go out and listen to the live music and hear the original music of the bands because it's great. It's a little piece of their soul.
To support my friends that are playing, and plus, it's therapy, right? Music's therapy. I love it.
Well, hi there. My name is Dana. I play in several bands in London town. The show I play tonight is with Twin Fin. We played at Fitzray's. I play in some other bands. I play in the Alcoholies, also Hill Valley Lightning, and another band called Bang Bang. I actually have a song that I wrote in the Alcoholies called Demolition in Speed City, and it's about all the venues in this town that just continuously close. Demolition, Speed City, Demolition, Downtown Detroit, Demolition, Speed City. I grew up going to the Embassy. That's where I first started going out to shows and playing with my band in high school called Interstate 69. So that was a great scene for a teenager in this town. But unfortunately, the Embassy is now a pile of rubble, as is, you know, the Brunswick Hotel is now a parking lot. And recently, the Blackshire Pub is also a pile of rubble. So it's getting tough to find venues to play in this city. So I'm glad there are places like Fitzray's, the London Music Hall, which has recently done some renovations, getting some big shows in there, and Twin Fin's actually going to be opening up for David Wilcox.
So that's pretty exciting for us.
Yeah, I like to go see live music because it's really important. I like to support artists in the city.
My name is Archie Gamble, and I am the drummer for the band The Buffalo Brothers, based out of London, Ontario. And I'm also a working musician that travels on cruise ships. It's always nice to come back to the music scene in London because it's very thriving, and there's a lot of very talented musicians here. I've been playing professionally full-time for coming up for 30 years, 29 years. I started playing in clubs when I was 15. That was just weekends, sporadic here and there. And at the age of 18, I turned professional playing. You know, there used to be a circuit that existed in Canada where you could play 52 weeks a year if you wanted to, across the country, 6-7 nights a week. So I did that for a few years from the age of 18 on. It's become harder to maintain a career as a professional musician. And, you know, it's gone up and down over the years in terms of how many venues there are. I've seen a lot of changes in the last 25 years I've lived here. A lot of the opportunities have dried up, but it's still there. You just have to apply yourself and you have to sacrifice. You know, it's, any musician will tell you it's not an easy way to make a living. But at the end of the day, you're doing what you love. And so that's the yin to the yang, you know.
Part of the City of London's music strategy, they've recently hired a music industry development officer, Corey Crossman. Corey took some time to share his thoughts with me. He says it's great to see the new venues popping up, like the Vic, 765 Old East, and new music nights at Fitzroy's. It's important for venues to offer opportunities for live music to take place, especially original artists. After all, original artists are what make cities like Seattle, Nashville, and Chicago great music cities.
Now it's time for our community radio report. Last February, Western University's Student Council held a motion to add a referendum to seize funding to the campus radio station on the basis that only a small portion of students actually benefit from the station, while every student contributes funding to CHRW from their tuition.
Everyone's student experience at Western is different. So as much as we have all of these different opportunities on campus, the USC needs to understand that, of course, not everyone's going to take advantage of the different opportunities. I mean, having campus radio has contributed to my Western experience, and I think that is incredible. And now that I'm going to graduate, it's definitely going to be something that I can look back on and hopefully use as kind of a jumpstart into a career. Being a volunteer at CHRW has opened so many different doors for me. As someone who wants to be in the journalism industry after I finish my degree, I've been able to host a radio show. I've been able to attend events and write stories on them and interview people. And it's just all these different things that are contributing to my experience at CHRW that I wouldn't have been able to do anywhere else.
CHRW volunteers, students, and community members came together to organize a campaign highlighting the importance of community and campus radio.
We had lots of really great input from our volunteers, both community and our student volunteers, and it was really awesome to see everyone really come together and build something for the station and for the presentation. We had about 8 volunteers that ended up presenting the day of. And the flurry of activity that happened before the presentation was, it felt really good to see that support. We also had, I think, about 60 community members and volunteers that came out to see the presentation that we did with the USC. And to see that room really fill up was, you're really feeling the love and the support.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by the volunteers at CHRW in London, Ontario. Music this week was by Whoopso, and headlines this week were written by Ome Selma Rahamtula and Sarah May Chitty. We also thank Gretchen King, Sarah May Chitty, and Istiana Bastari. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncr.ca or podcast at rabble.ca/podcasts.